All right.
Hello and welcome back to Pittsburgh Liberation Radio. This is your host, Nick, and tonight we have returning guests Ahmed and Kareem back on the show to share stories of struggle in Palestine. Last time they were on, they gave us a wide view of their connection to Palestine, the impact Zionism has had on their families historically and contemporaneously, and the movement for Palestine in the U.S. here. Today, we'd like to further the project of humanizing Palestinians with Kareem and Ahmed, sharing stories of the Palestinian struggle, both ongoing now and from their families' histories. As Zionist barbarity somehow continues to escalate almost beyond comprehension with the recent bombing in Rafah, simply surviving in Gaza is a heroic act of resistance and humanity. So with that said, Kareem, Ahmed, thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us, Nick. Well, glad to be here.
Absolutely. So last time we didn't spend as much time, I think, as we might have liked on this, but I know you both have family in Gaza, many of whom have been tragically murdered by Israel. So can you give us a view into what's going on right now with your loved ones, friends, family, and just share some stories of what's going on and what they're actually experiencing?
Sure. Do you want to start?
No, please, go ahead, Kareem.
Okay, so my family, we have quite a few members that still live in Gaza, actually spread out throughout the Gaza Strip. But predominantly, a lot of our family is in the south. We have some family in the north right now that are kind of cut off from food, water supply. It's estimated somewhere around 400 or 500,000 people are still stuck in the north. And those family members, we don't have any contact with them, very little contact if they can ever get any. And then on top of that, we know that they're not getting any food and water, at least not in large quantities, and they have to ration whatever they can get. So we're very concerned about them. The ones in the south are ones that still have the ability to shelter. They still have some homes that are intact. But just last week, my uncle, his home with my cousins that live over there, their building was struck. That strike did not take the whole building down, but it did cause severe damage. They were able to escape, but then the rest of the building went up in flames shortly after, so they cannot go back to that home. And they're currently on the street or looking for shelter with tents or anything that they can find at this time. So situation is awful. It doesn't matter where you are now, at north or south, it's all being struck. And you know, our hearts go out to them and we try to help it, but it's hard to get any help to them.
It's, I think it's very frustrating, to be honest, to hear even our own politicians saying that we're focused on getting humanitarian aid and increasing humanitarian aid to the people of Gaza. Yet we know for a fact that the people in the north are literally eating animal feed right now. And even that has ran out, and they're resorting to just anything. Like, they're asking, is it permissible to eat like donkey meat or this meat or anything else just to survive? And to think that the aid is there, the aid is coming, but it's being stopped at the border, and it's not like there is not aid. The aid is there, but it's not making it there. And when they try to make it out there, we also have the footage of the aid truck that was shelled trying to get to the north.
Yeah.
And to be honest, all the scenes are horrific and all the scenes are very difficult. But for me, I grew up in the South, right? So I grew up in Khan Yunis. And while I recognized whenever they were talking about the shelling in the north or in the middle, what's been happening in Khan Yunis is like beyond shocking for me. Like, we're talking about streets that I used to walk. I'm talking about like schools that I used to go to, mosques that I used to pray in. Families that I used to have, like friends and neighbors, like we played soccer together, we walked the streets together. And now I hear, I see footage and I'm like, this is our street, but it's not, there's not a street anymore. The houses are all gone. They'll say, like, so-and-so's family just got bombed. And I'm like, oh my God, like, he's like my high school friend, or we went together in like middle school. Like, it's no longer, it is so personal. It's beyond, you don't have to imagine it. Like, you know it for a fact. And that's just to think that it's been almost 130 days and we're still at it. We're still going through that struggle. And, Kareem mentioned the burning of the building. literally, like my sister's house was bombed, I think maybe the very first week in Gaza. And the building stayed up, but you know, it got super damaged. And my niece was getting married. Like, she was supposed to get married, I think, in November. So, you know, they had all of these things prepared for the wedding, and you know, they had them in suitcases. And when they heard that the suitcases were still intact, like that those suitcases, like they lost everything, but for them it didn't matter, because those two suitcases that represented like hope that, you know, one day she can still have her wedding and, you know, have some stuff that they brought for the wedding. They last week, as the Israeli soldiers were leaving that area, they put that building on fire and completely torched it. And it was like, so that sliver of hope that they had, like, you know, to find the silver lining in a horrible situation, you know, so many like deaths and family members getting lost and everything else. But they sort of like, hey, you know, those suitcases are still there. And then, like, you know, they messaged and said, no, they burned the entire building. This is what it looks like now. Somebody sent us a photo. And you're like, you know, what do you say to them other than, hey, please stay strong, stay resilient. You know, we're here with you. We, you know, it's, you know.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking.
Very heartbreaking, for sure.
I mean, the level of inhumanity being expressed by the Zionist state is almost incomprehensible. And, you know, it's almost like in the act of dehumanizing the Palestinians for all these years, they've lost their own humanity, because this is not how people act toward each other. And they just have they've just lost all sense of it. And I mean, me personally, like, I vacillate between, I don't obviously have the personal connections I couldn't that you and Kareem do. But I mean, I vacillate every day between anger and being on the edge of tears, just because I'm actively trying to watch this stuff. And I think a lot of people just aren't seeing it. And I don't know if they're willfully ignoring it. I'm sure that's some of it. But part of it is that it's just, unless you're looking at something like Al Jazeera or The Cradle, like, you're not getting that media, or you're curating your own, you know, social media experience to make sure that you see what's going on and are keeping up to date.
No, you're absolutely right. I would say, you know, and thank you for having us back again, but, you know, the last podcast, we went and dove into our political expectations of what we thought was going to happen and people standing up for humanity. And then the unfortunate reality of business interests and international foreign policy starting to take precedence over humanitarian needs and efforts. And it's a shame because, you know, we're ones that were horrified by the Holocaust as well from 100 years ago. And it was said back then, never again. And we thought that meant for all of humanity, you know, that was the whole idea, is to make sure that this never happens again to anyone, to any race. But here we are, we're literally facing genocide and genocidal intent from one party to another. And it's been proven from the international court that is the intent that's being taken right now, which, you know, to us, we all have to be as vocal as possible and all have to, you know, do our part to make sure that we try to put an end to this as quickly as we can, because there's people dying every day and suffering every day and going hungry every day, and children and women and men. And
yeah,
just cannot stay quiet. So this is, we thank you for this opportunity, and we certainly will continue to share whatever we can to do so.
Yeah. So, to that point, just because we still need, we've had, you know, movements all over the country calling for a ceasefire, you know, calling for a free Palestine. To me, it's like, we still need more. We obviously need more. We need even more pressure. So I'd like to hear from both of you, and you've already shared a story, but if you were talking to somebody that had no experience about, you know, no experience, not much historical context around the situation here, they're not quite sure what's going on, what story would you tell them in the hope that it would radicalize them enough to, you know, maybe join a rally or a protest or write their senator? I mean, how would you approach them, like, from a human level?
You know, a lot of people think about that, hey, this whole conflict happened in October 7th. And, you know, this is what happened on October 7th. And this is the consequence of what happens on October 7th. And I really, like, to me, that immediately tells me that this person probably doesn't know a lot about the history of the conflict and the history of what's happening to the Palestinian people for the last 75 years, right? I come from a refugee family. I was born in a refugee camp in Khan Yunis, but I was blessed to grow up with both of my grandparents and them sharing stories with us. They were born, like, both of them were born like in 1919, 1920. And they talk about, you know, they talk about where they came from. They talk about this beautiful city of Alid, and talk about how they had, you know, orange orchards, how they had, like my grandfather had a really great business, like, you know, literally a trading business where he actually would take the train to Gaza, like drive the car to Gaza. And you're like, you know, you hear stories where like, no, it was a desert back then. There were no people there. And then you're like, but that's not true. Like they had theater, they had movies, they had an airline. Like there was a completely, you know, beautiful country that was there. There were currency. They even had their own soccer team that went and was playing Australia for the world qualifier. So like you know, and you just sort of like, you're like, really, that's all of that was happening there. And then they start telling you about what happened after that and how that they lost everything. Literally in a matter of one day, they lost everything that they owned. They thought they're going to come back. They thought they were going to come back in, you know, a few days. They really didn't take anything with them. And here, my grandmother and my grandfather, and even like, you know, separated the men from the women. So like my grandmother was by herself with all of her young kids trying to survive, trying that they'd actually keep them alive and trying to find a way to feed them. And, you know, like literally having no water, having nothing to cook for them. She always tells us the story about she literally likes tuna because when she was, you know, at the time when she was trying to find food to feed my uncles and my dad, that she found this can of tuna and she, like, it was empty, and then she used it and put a little bit of oil in there, and she cooked eggplant, and that's what she found in the farm, and that's what she fed the kids, and that's how she sort of like dealt with their hunger. And you heard that story and you're like, oh, you know, thank God, like we're never going to deal through that again. You know, this is, at least we're not going to go through that, right? And here you go, 75 years later, and all we hear are the stories of people who are struggling to get food to eat, kids who are dying from hunger, kids who are dying from thirst, kids who are dying from being so scared. And you're like, Karim talked about the Holocaust and everybody said, hey, never again, right? Never again. This will never happen again. And we talked about the Nakba and what happened to the Palestinians in 1948. And we said, never again. And here we are in 2023, 2024, and it's happening all over again. And you're like, have we not learned? And what's really scary about it is that it's being broadcasted real time for us right now. We see it. It's not, we don't have to hear about it in books months or, you know, years later. This is literally real time. Bissan is streaming to us what's happening in the hospital. Real time, we're seeing people being snipered and killed and shot and bombed in the orthopedic section in the Nasser Hospital. Like, we don't have to think about it. We're seeing it real time. And to think that as humans and as a population of our country and all the other countries, that we're not rising up and saying enough is enough, that we, enough suffering, we can't, you know, like we've had 12,000-13,000 kids have been killed so far, and we cannot have this happen anymore. We need to have that to stop. And they still have people question whether we need to continue to support and send additional arms to Israel to continue to kill innocent people. That is just beyond me. I honestly don't, I can't understand it.
Well said, Ahmed. Thank you for sharing that. I'm going to tackle this from a different angle. And I think it's important to bring the human side a little bit here, because there's a lot in the media kind of just shows Palestinians as barbaric animals and they're just out there to, you know, go after Israel or something. But the reality is this. I think it's better to kind of explain our history, because it just shows that Palestinians were just either farmers or merchants or businessmen or engineers. And they were educated people that just a regular country, just like any other country, that had the hopes and dreams of bettering their country and growing. My father, who was born in 1941, 7 years before the Nakba, happened of 1948. And Nakba means the catastrophe. And why do they call that 1948 the catastrophe? It's that that was the year that Israel was formed as a state, and it was done by force. And I'll explain kind of what happened with our family. My father, my grandfather, my great-grandfather, and my great-great-grandfather, we're all from a city called Bir Seba, which is now known as Bir Sheba. And that area is approximately 50 kilometers east of Gaza, where it is today. Where we lived there, where there were merchants there, my family was always known as the merchant family. And in 1948, there was already word going around that there's going to be some violence and people need to be careful and need to be in their homes. But there was one sudden event that happened where a bomb strike took out the neighbor right next to our home where my father and his family lived. And it killed everybody that was there. And my great-grandfather at the time came in to the home and asked my grandmother and my father and all the siblings. He had two brothers and three sisters. So you guys have to come with us. The whole family, we're rounding up everybody, and we're going to go towards Gaza, but only approximately 10 kilometers west towards Gaza. And then hang out there for a little bit until things settle down, and then just leave your stuff here. We're going to come back to our home once this settles down. So they packed some minor things, and they started by foot making their way over to a neighboring town. When they quickly realized as they're doing that was a long trip, that town was a far distance for them to walk, and there was little children. Like, my father was the oldest out of six, so they had babies with them at a time, and he was only 7 years old. So as they're making this trip over to a neighboring town, one of my uncles, which would be his younger brother, was 3 years old. He ends up getting sick on the way, and they couldn't get him a doctor. So within a couple of days, he ended up dying. And on to add more issues is that once they arrived to the town by foot, they stayed there with some people that they knew. But it turns out that the Israeli soldiers at the time cut off all supplies to that town. So there were no food, no water, and people were rationing. And then some people were also out of food. And even though they stayed there for a few days, at that point, it started getting pretty serious that they needed food. And there was no local supplies, so they had to head back into town. But instead of doing that, my great-grandfather asks one of his sons, who's an older boy, and he says, "Listen, I need you to go in there and find some flour." He says, "Well, the soldiers are still there." He said, "We know, but you need to get it, or otherwise we're all not going to make it." So he decided to sacrifice one of his children at the time to go back and find any food. And their hope was to find a bag of flour so they can make some bread. So he was known as one of the tougher ones in the family, this uncle of my father at the time. And then he went in and managed to get a bag of flour and make it back to the family. And that's how my family ended up surviving. So our entire existence basically depended on him being able to get food for the family. And this was for approximately 40 people that he got this food for. They were able to make some bread, and then they decided that based off of the information that they received at the time, that there's no chance for them to get back to their home. Israel decided to take over the town, and they're not giving it back, and it's now going to be Israel's land. So the idea at that point was to continue the pilgrimage over to Gaza and find harbor and safety over there with some family members. And they ended up, making it to Rafah, which is the most southern part of Gaza. So at that point, that's where my family's story kind of starts. The Nakba has kind of defined our entire life, because I didn't get a chance to be born in Palestine or to be even born in our hometown of Bir Sheba or Bir Seba. And ever since then, we've been really just refugees from one place to another. Like, my father decided to get an education out in Egypt, and he had the opportunity to do so, which was fantastic. Got his accounting degree, ended up getting a job, and then just living his life outside of Palestine, but he didn't have any paperwork. So he was a refugee for everywhere he went, you know, whether he went to, I think Kuwait is what accepted him at the time, but he was sitting there being sponsored in Kuwait and couldn't get a Kuwaiti citizenship. So that's the story of a lot of Palestinians, is a story of struggle, and nothing really comes easy, and it's always about survival. But nowhere in that story will you hear anything about, oh, we hated Israel and we tried to murder them and kill them. As a matter of fact, it was always the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
They decided that they want to take over that land. They wanted to take it over forcibly. There was forcible displacement going on at the time and killing of innocent lives to make that happen. Anybody that would resist it would die immediately. They'd be either shot or killed in one way or another, or bombed. And it was... this is the story of a Palestinian's life. And it's important to know this part, because it doesn't matter who you are. I think realizing that it didn't start on October 7th is probably the biggest thing that we're discussing right now. This has been going on for 75 years, and even longer if you consider, you know, the backstory before that. But certainly 1948 was the biggest milestone in terms of the forced displacement of Palestinians.
And it's important to note that, like, you know, Karim, you touched on something very important, which is a lot of people who are trying to sort of sow hate or, you know, separation between us will say, well, this is a religious conflict. It is, you know, it's the Muslims against the Jews. And that is cannot be further from the truth, right?
Right.
Like, my grandfather talks about how literally with his neighbor, they would share meals. Like, you know, they would, I guess in Lid, they were, you know, famous for watermelons as well. And they would take it over to their Jewish neighbors and they would share that with them. And their Jewish neighbors would share some of their, you know, if they were immigrants. And this is like, again, those are not even like, you know, we're not talking about Arab Jews. Those are like people that were immigrants, that were basically refugees that came from wherever they were oppressed and came and became their neighbors. And they would share meals together. And it seemed to be peaceful until, you know, certain militia groups and the whole idea of creating Israel and pushing the Arabs out of their land. You know, we had a great opportunity having the right people there at the time to make sure that everybody lives cohesively together, peacefully. Muslims, Jewish, and Christian folks, and even non-religious folks have lived peacefully together in this area of land for many, many, many years before the creation of the State of Israel. So again, it's important for people to know that. And, you know, fast forward 75 years later, you know, like, again, it's the stories that we keep hearing, just to stick with like our story theme for this podcast. Like, I actually heard this story, and I don't know if I shared it before or not, but I heard this story for the first time a couple of months ago. And this was my father telling us when he was in 1967. So he would have been about 18 years old. At this time, they would have been in Gaza for about, you know, their family would have been in Gaza for about 20 years now or so, or something like that, right? And when Israel invaded the Gaza Strip, they were looking for like landmines or something like that. They came over to the house and they took my father from the house. And my grandmother at the time, he was like, well, no, don't take him, take his father. Like, don't, you know, keep the boy, you know? And he's like, no, I want him. So the soldiers took my dad. And they literally, the reason why they took him is because they want him to go through a couple of areas and go in there and dig. So if there's like a landmine or something, it blows up in him and not in them, right?
Talk about human shields.
Yeah, talk about human shields. Like literally, like they, and this is, and he tells the story now, like, you know, my dad is almost 75 years old. And you talk about the story and he tells it like, you know, vividly about how he went in there. He gave him a small shovel and he told him to dig, right? And, you know, think about like if he blew up, I wouldn't be around, right? Like the whole idea of the fact that he went in there and then that he survived, and, you know, he survived to tell the story, but didn't tell the story now till he felt to share it after he saw all of those videos and all of those footage. It's almost like he blocked that memory in his mind. And now you see the stories. We also the story of the doctor that ran and sort of like, you know, risked her life to save the young man who was shot. We all know this. We all heard the story about Hind, you know, and this is what's really, for me, like, you know, sometimes you almost have to block those in order for you to continue to push forward and continue to look for, you know, a peaceful resolution for this, and to continue to say, we want to end the occupation. And sometimes you block those thoughts and memories. Like the fact that you know, not even, it hasn't even been 3 weeks since one of our cousins, you know, was shot, killed in front of his, in front of his children. Like, how are they going to move on? Like, somebody said something the other day and said, we talk about what's going to happen and how we're going to find a peaceful resolution for this conflict. And somebody said, think about the 17,000 children who got orphans so far in Gaza. 17,000 yeah. orphans, right? And to think about that, you know, some of our nieces and nephews are some of those orphan kids. And how are they going to live on? How are they going to sort of like not having a father, not having a mother, and then witnessing all of these atrocities around them and still be able to have the mental health to continue on and live on? Like, these are real stories of real kids that, if you know, in the US here, we hear story of one, you know, we, you know, makes it in the news, one story of one kid, and, you know, the entire country sort of stops and starts praying for that one child and make sure, you know, they're safe. And yet, it almost on a daily basis, we hear stories of hundreds of Palestinian children that are being killed, injured, or orphaned. Kids that are saying things like, uncle, are my legs going to grow back up again after they've amputated the legs of a child who's 5 years old? What do you say to that child?
Yeah.
And so like, these are the stories that are coming from there. And these are the stories and the videos that people are seeing. And if that does not move, like, if that doesn't break your heart, if that doesn't open your heart, then we really, truly have to self-reflect and try to figure out what's wrong with us. Because if that doesn't move us, if that does not move us to stand up and to demand a ceasefire, to demand a peaceful resolution for this conflict, I don't know what would.
No, yeah, absolutely. It's all... Yeah, I mean, it has to inspire you to action, or else you've lost a piece of your humanity, I think. I mean, and I don't know what that action could be. There's a lot of ways to get out there and get involved, calling your representatives, you know, again, joining organizations and rallies and everything. But yeah, I mean, at some level, it's like, once you've been exposed to this, I don't know how to really, you know, how to talk to you anymore. You know what I mean? If you can be exposed to this and not be moved in some way. You know, and just in general, as you guys are talking here, we're seeing so many echoes of the past and what's actually happening right now. I mean, we're talking about blockading towns, the prevention of food, mining, you know, mining houses. One story I heard the other day is that, like, you know, in parts where Israel, like, at least temporarily controls or are attempting to maintain control, they're like mining houses for people to go back to. So that's like another thing that, like, people are going to have to think about in Gaza. Going back, like, did they mine my houses? And that's something that they did in the Nakba as well, as they were destroying, I think, 540 Palestinian villages. And it's just that in this whole conversation on, you know, violence, Israel is the origin. The state project of Israel is the originator, the source of all the violence in the region, to the point about people, humans living, regardless of their religion, living peacefully side by side. Before the creation, the forcible creation of the state of Israel.
You're absolutely right, Nick. There's so much to share here, obviously, but I think there's a lot of simplicity to this at this point. If you don't need to know the entire history of Palestine and Israel to really understand what's going on. I think once we can get over ourselves in terms of, yes, there's political interest to align ourselves in terms of, you know, international foreign policy with Israel. It's very convenient to have a partner slash ally in the Middle East due to our foreign policy. But at what cost, right?
Maybe our foreign policy needs to change. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, I know, but I think that I'm just talking about the major talking point, right? Like, Nick, the talking point from our politicians are, oh, we need Israel, we need this ally, and so on and so forth for our foreign policy interests. Okay. Listen, as an American, I think it's very important to take a look at the overall interest of America. But again, at what cost, right? Like, this is the part that we have to ask ourselves. Are we willing to give up our human side, our humanity, our decency for saying, yeah, as long as it meets our interests, we can kill tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people, or we can forcibly displace them. They can go to Egypt. I mean, why are they still in Palestine? We can kick them out of their land, right? Like, it's no big deal. We'll just figure. And this is the whole idea, is that there's serious repercussions to this, right? Genocides are never forgotten.
When he says at what cost, right? Whenever the next big event that happens around the world, whether it's let's put it this way, as America, as quote-unquote the leader of the free world, how are we going to be able to go to somebody like Burma and say, your treatment of the Rohingya refugees is unacceptable, and you should not be doing this, and you should be giving them rights, and you should be doing all of these things, right? Or going to India and saying, hey, you should be respecting minority rights, and so on and so forth. How are we going to pretend to be on the right side of history when we just basically not only witnessed what the Israeli army has been doing in Gaza and the 30,000 lives that were killed and that 10,000 more lives that at least buried under plus almost 100,000 injured, right? Mm-hmm. And we didn't do anything about it. In fact, we supported it. Not only did we not do anything about it, I don't think the world is going to listen to us. No. The world is going to say, you know, you're asking us to do what you say, but you don't say what you don't do what you say. You do the quite the opposite. So we lose our credibility. And then the one thing that we all have to recognize, that the future of this world is the young generation. It's not our generation. You know, it's the young generation, generation that is currently observing and watching what we're doing, not just in the US, not just in Europe, not just in Africa and Asia, all over the world, right? They're literally observing and watching our behavior. And we're definitely not putting a good example for them on how we can value human life and how we can do what we can to save those innocent lives that are literally being lost every day in Gaza.
No, I agree. And like, I agree with everything you said with respect to the credibility on the world stage, especially with the ICJ ruling, right? And all the votes for a ceasefire that happened at the UN. And just at the domestic level, again, to your point, like, I think there's a lot of people, especially younger people, that are asking the question when they throw out these terms like, oh, it's in America's interest. And it becomes kind of like cognitive dissonance when it's like, why is it in my interest to slaughter Palestinians? Like, whose interest is this in, you know?
Yeah, there's, I want to add to Ahmed's point, this particular point. The hypocrisy is becoming very evident. And some people may disagree with this, but there was an interview that was just held yesterday with a politician from the White House, and they were asking him, like, what are your thoughts on the Ukraine-Russia war? We said Russia created a lot of damage to Ukraine, and they're responsible for the damage that they've created, and they will have to pay the price to rebuild Ukraine. And then one of the reporters responds and says, okay, well, appreciate that. What are your thoughts on the Gaza war? Is Israel going to be responsible to rebuild Gaza? And then the guy starts stuttering a little bit. He said, well, you know, that's not okay. And then he starts stuttering. And it's just, he got caught off guard because they see Ukraine and Russia as one thing. And yes, we understand there's differences between the wars for sure, lots of difference. But the principle's still the same. There's a power that is greater than another. And that power is being abused to take over a weaker opponent, right? And it's happening in both cases, but the U.S. has decided that Israel doing that is okay. And we're going to stand behind them for our own personal reasons. And the hypocrisy is just awful to see in my nature. I mean, it's just, you know, there's only so many things you can say to convince people that this is still okay. And I think it's going to catch up with us. There's only so much you can say at this point to allow this to go on for a short period of time, but it's going to reverberate throughout history. And as an American, I just can't possibly accept that. I know that I'm also Palestinian, but from the reality as an American, I'm looking at this, I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed.
And I think it's important to note that, you know, we're not, this is not a fringe opinion, right? This is the, no. Like if this, you know, this is an opinion of 70 to 80% of the population in the United States is in full support of a ceasefire. There is a challenge. There's a problem when we say that we're a democracy, that our elected officials are telling the population, the young generation, our generation, older generations, the voters, to tell them that even though you are asking us for a ceasefire, even though that you believe that enough bloodshed has been spilled and that we need to stop the carnage and stop the genocide, that we know better than you, and we're not going to call for a ceasefire because, you know what, it's complicated. You wouldn't understand. And that is a problem. That is a very big and inherent problem in our system. If our elected officials are not going to respond to the demand of the population, of the people that put them in power to start with, then the system is broken. Mm-hmm. And we have to reflect on that and say, you know, don't come and talk to me on that moral code when you saw children being slaughtered and did not do anything about it. You had the power to go and bring food into the north of Gaza so people don't starve to death. You had the power to bring supplies and fuel so that kids do not die from the cold, and you didn't do anything about it. You gave us lip service. But the fact of the matter, from our families, from the people who are living there, they're telling us the truth. And the truth is that they're starving, that they're hungry, that they're cold. And yet, you are not listening when we're asking you to go and demand a ceasefire. So that is really something that is going to be reckoning with whenever it's time for election cycle. Maybe not this cycle, maybe it's the cycle after it. But the fact of the matter is, people who are observing this are gonna take note and say, you know what, I remember when all these kids were being killed in Gaza, and that my elected official chose to just close a blind eye on it because he's being supported by special interests, by lobby groups. And because of that, I will remember that, and I will go find another candidate that will take care about my interests as a U.S. citizen, as a country, and actually take care of us instead of going after special interest groups and taking care of their interests and their demands.
Yeah. No, and to the point about getting aid, I mean, they could do that, and they could also stop sending weapons and bombs.
That is like, you know, we all saw the higher commissioner from the European Union, the guy in charge of the foreign policy there. And he said, well, you keep saying that the number of dead people are not acceptable, right? There are too many people in Gaza being killed. He said, like, here's an idea for you. Stop sending weapons and the number will drop. Like, that is common sense right there. You want the killing to stop? Stop sending bombs over there.
Going back to, like, just to add to your point on the hypocrisy, right? There's so many areas of hypocrisy. And one is that, oh, we're losing too many people in support for the Democratic Party and the government right now because of the way we're acting. So we're going to go out there and say, no, we're standing up for humanitarian effort. We need to help the Palestinians, get humanitarian aid in there, reduce the number of people that are killed. Yet that's talking out of the side of our mouths because we're still sending bombs. We're still sending weapons to kill those people. So that is an incredible amount of hypocrisy that's taking place live in front of our eyes. And if we can just think for a moment, switch on our critical thinking brains, and instead of watching TV and believing what's happening on the media all the time and what they're trying to tell us all the time. And I don't mind listening to the media. I'm listening to Fox, CNN, MSNBC, all kinds of different news, Al Jazeera. I'll listen to them all. But at least we got to listen from some critical thought when we understand that if there's just a bias approach, we need to be careful not to just listen to that bias. There's another area that's really important. I mean, we're talking about this. Oh, this is such a complex history between Israel and Palestine, and you would never understand it. Well, the history between Ukraine and Russia in the European region with all these other countries involved in that history is so complex. But when they come to talk about Ukraine and Russia, it's so straightforward. It's so simple. There's no complexity at that point. Oh, Russia, evil power, taking over Ukraine. We must help Ukraine. It's as simple as that. People are dying in Ukraine. We need to save them. But then when it comes to say the same thing about Palestine, all of a sudden it doesn't matter anymore.
Right.
What is happening to the world? And yet we still believe what we're hearing. This is where we just implore everybody to start being unapologetic, to say, you know what, it's time for us to be the conscience of this country, to bring back the conscience, to bring back the morality of what it is that we're supposed to do, and demanding that from our politicians and from our leaders. At this point, it's within their hands, and America being the greatest power right now politically in the world, I think it's going to be on us to really take action.
No, definitely agree. I mean, it's very clear that it's on the people, and we're the only ones that have the power to really affect the change. So with that said, I think we can probably leave it there. Do you guys have anything to talk about locally in terms of how people can actually flex that power and get involved upcoming?
I want to give a shout out to, remember to be able to donate to some of those organizations on the ground that are trying to help those people, especially with the U.S. stubbing the funding for UNRWA. Being able to go in there and supplement that, so that, because they're still doing great work on the ground and they're still trying to help families there. And then to continue to speak up. And I know in the beginning we were talking about how sharing stories with our family members and other, neighbors and colleagues, we got to continue to do that because it's a grassroots effort. Believe me, you can just reaching one person at work or reaching one person at school might change that person forever and sort of open their heart, and they will be the next person to open somebody else's heart, because we have to continue to do that grassroots effort.
Yep.
Absolutely. And I'll summarize it from my end. I think if there's any takeaways and what is being asked and what can be done, you can just narrow it down to these three areas. Number one is call for an immediate and unconditional ceasefire to our politicians. Number two, to ask them to please stop sending warheads and military weapons to help and aiding killing more people in Palestine. Number three is to open up humanitarian aid and fundraising to the Palestinian people that are starving, that Israel is still blockading every single entry point of any supplies going into Gaza. And then again, that goes back to the genocidal intent of what's going on over there. These are the demands that we need to be making. And if you are voting, if you go to the polls and vote, then you have the right to reach out to any politician, local politicians, state senators, congressmen and women. They all have to listen to you. And we need everyone to speak up at this point to put the pressure on. In terms of the fundraising efforts, if you want to send money to UNRWA, it's a real critical situation right now with them, because the U.S. decided to even cut off funding to them. At this point, like Ahmed mentioned. So UNRWA is a great one. Palestinian Children Relief Fund is a good one. And there's lots of children that need help over there right now. So those are the things. They're fairly, it's not a big ask in a lot of ways, because these are things that you can send an email from your desk to your congressman and women, and it makes a big impact. So thanks to everyone that is doing all the work out there. There's plenty of beautiful people and organizations that are doing great work. And shout out to PSL as well. And JVP and all kinds of beautiful organizations that are doing a lot of work in the background to help.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. We're happy to do it. I want to add, just in terms of like the political pressure, locally, we've got a resolution coming to the table at the Allegheny County Council for the county to support a ceasefire. And that kind of stuff matters. That requires organization. It requires talking to local elected representatives. But again, in a democratic dominated kind of geography like we're at in Pittsburgh here in Allegheny County. I mean, again, as like the national party sees more and more of these cities, towns, counties demanding a ceasefire, that's another way to add that kind of political pressure. So I'll link in the episode description who you need to email to make your voice heard on that front to support that countywide resolution that's impending here.
Absolutely. That's a very important thing. As a matter of fact, you brought up something like just 3 hours ago, I was on a call with one of the Allegheny County councilmen, and we're finding out that there's a lot of resistance there, and they do need a lot of people to send out emails and to show up to meetings to put the pressure on to allow for them to call for a ceasefire. If they don't get enough support, then it makes it very difficult. There's 15 councilmen that are on the board there, and they need 8 out of 15 votes, so just the majority is what's needed to pass a ceasefire resolution. The problem is on October 25th and 26th, actually, October 26th, they passed a resolution back then unanimously with real ease at the time to condemn Hamas and the killing of Hamas and to support Israel's attack on Palestine. And it's shameful if you go through the resolution that there's a lot of wording in there about just allowing Israel to defend itself in any way, shape, or form, regardless of the consequence. it's basically our county has given them the green light to say, yeah, we'll support you.
The green light for genocide. When I hear, sorry to like get riled up here, but when I hear stand for Israel, everybody listening to this, when you hear like Israel's right to defend itself or stand with Israel, basically means co-sign Israeli genocide against the Palestinians. That's what it means.
And I think that's what they're drumming up, is that kind of support. Well, then, you know, you fast forward 3.5 months and the ICJ takes its course. And then you have 17 international judges, independent from all around the countries across the world, that are part of the ICJ. And they come up with a resolution or a ruling at the end saying that, you know, there is genocidal intent that's being taken place. Not accidental genocide, intent for genocide that's taking place. And if that's the case, and we're still supporting this resolution, then shame on us. At this point, we need to bring that to the forefront. And it's quite easy. You could show up to one of these meetings or even send an email and say, hey, are you guys still backing this resolution that you signed back on October 26th? Because guess what? You're basically still given the green light for genocide at this point. And again, this hypocrisy cannot last. It's only temporary. It's only short term. And we better correct our path before it's too late. I mean, right now, every day that goes by, it just makes the matter worse and worse for us to be able to redeem ourselves from the entire world. So as Americans, as Pennsylvanians, as Pittsburghers, we need to take some pride in what we do and who we are and our identity, and time to get back to our constitution and the rights for all human beings to have a chance at life here. And so that's all I have to say about that. But it's incredible the forces that are against us with this. Really, it's incredible.
And yet I find, you know, inspiration and hope and joy in the fact that our beautiful group and community here in Pittsburgh, who come out day after day in the cold, they're not getting tired. They're standing, they're shouting, they're demanding a ceasefire. And then those people who are doing all this hard work, to you, from the people of Gaza, from our families to your families, we are grateful. We're grateful for everything that you have been doing. We're grateful for all of your efforts. We see you, we hear you, we feel you. And we are so grateful for everything that you do.
Well, on that note, I think we can leave it there. Go out, get involved, donate, make your voice heard. You know, we need you. We need the quantity into quality. More people, have those conversations, get people out onto the streets and writing letters, et cetera, et cetera. But Kareem, Ahmed, thank you so much for sharing these stories and for this closing conversation. I think it's very important that we continue to do this until there's a ceasefire and we have an end to the occupation and a free Palestine. So thank you so much for the time, gentlemen. And I'm sure I'll see you in person again very soon.
Thank you so much for having us.